I'm not perfect. I still do feel overwhelmed sometimes and have a bit of a cry or how can I do this? I look back at my former self and times when I had so much on and I felt like I couldn't get through it. And I'm like, Izzy, you did get through it. You know, it was hard, but you got through it. And that actually really gives me the confidence in myself to know, you know, this, you'll also get through this challenge too.
Whether it's the clothes you wear to work or a metaphor for putting up a front, we all wear a uniform. But often there's a lot going on behind the uniform, and many of us are reluctant to express how we are really feeling.
Each week on Behind the Uniform, Dr. Izzy Smith and Captain Hugo Tovey will be joined by a special guest as they talk openly and honestly about their experiences with mental health. Nothing will be off limits, so prepare yourself for tears, laughter and goosebumps.
Welcome back, everyone, to Behind the Uniform podcast. We're getting through the episodes this season. We're pretty proud so far of what we've done, and we're just talking offline that although we're not in the studio, we're not here face to face. We're still pretty impressed with some of the amazing guests we've had on.
I know the feedback I've had is really positive, and I think it demonstrates that we're both learning as people and growing, and that's reflected in the quality of the guests we're having and the discussions we're having. And exactly what we wanted to do, go a little bit deeper into, you know, mental health and the topics associated with it.
Exactly is. And I think today is a bit of a special episode, and probably the next two episodes are going to be, I don't know whether you call them bonus episodes or special editions, but what we decided to do is we're both Movember ambassadors. This is a Movember podcast. It's the month of Movember. So we wanted to walk the walk. We wanted to take off our uniform, take off Izzy's scrubs, take off my army uniform, and also take off our bloody podcast hats for a minute. And start exploring each other's stories, why this podcast means a lot to us, why the whole concept of mental health and being comfortable with the uncomfortable conversations, what that actually means. So we thought that's the best place to start. And in this edition of this this episode, well, I'm going to be interviewing you, Iz. So,
you know, I'm a little bit nervous. When we came up with the idea, I was like, okay, you know, take off your, as you said, podcaster voice and uniform and walk the walk and be prepared to share a little bit of vulnerability, because we expect our guests to do that every week. So I guess if we can't also do that, we're a little bit hypocritical.
Exactly. And so that's what we're doing today. And this episode today, I'm going to be interviewing Iz, but it's going to be a bit more conversational. As I said to her before, it's like we're basically sitting there together having a coffee, and people listening to this who follow Izzy and follow her social media, she's extremely intelligent. And I think some of the concepts and issues that she talks about and topics she talks about on a daily basis on her Instagram, it's really refreshing and enlightening, and she's got a wonderful way that she does it. But I don't think often she talks enough about her personal life, which I'm sure there's reasons for that. But I think that it's important that we are both open, honest, and vulnerable.
And we can talk about that on the podcast. I think I don't share much about myself because I feel like, why would people want to know that? I'm a doctor. The only thing I can give to people is the medical knowledge. So maybe it is good for me to accept that, hey, it is okay to share about who you are and your story. And that is interesting and valid. So
exactly. So, well, let's get stuck in. And as we do with all our guests, I want to ask you the same question we do at the start, but I'm sure you've had enough time to think of this question. I'm surely, Izzy, but before we get into your story, before we get into some questions I'm keen to ask you, what is Dr. Izzy Smith doing when you are at your happiest?
I did have a bit of time to prepare, but it didn't take me long to think. I think because I am always really busy, I'm communicating constantly at work, I'm always on the go, I'm my happiest when I'm just being present and mindful. If that's going for a run and I can feel the sun on my back and the breeze in my face, or how wonderful water tastes when you're really thirsty, or if I'm playing with one of my little nieces or nephews and we're getting, you know, engaged in a very serious game of tea parties, and it's just that being present, that's when I'm, you know, really, really happy, and I just feel content with the world and who I am.
I love that, Iz. I love it. And you do love your outdoors, and offline you're just telling me you've got a potentially, if it's not cancelled, a pretty impressive triathlon coming up in Canberra.
Ooh, it'll be impressive if I do it. It has rained nonstop here, and swimming with lockdowns, there's been no pool, so I'm going to swim in a dirty lake tomorrow that often is like got green blue algae that's toxic. So I can't say I'm looking forward to that mindful moment tomorrow, but I'll get through.
I love that answer as well. I know how much our family means to you, and I know you're really looking forward to traveling and seeing your nephew and seeing your families interstate, which I am too. So let's just go way back. to little baby Iz, little baby Izzy, where you grew up, what the environment was like growing up, what your family dynamics were like, and then also we'll then touch on a pretty sort of tragic event that happened to you very, very young in your life.
So I am from Tasmania, but my mum and dad were from like New South Wales and Queensland, but they moved there and started a farm. My dad was super, super brainy, like IQ in the 160s or something crazy, but just wanted to be a farmer. It was like, you know, the hippie, like Woodstock kind of, you know, post-Vietnam War. Everyone wanted just to be hippies and, you know, smoke weed and go to festivals. So that was what my mum and dad were. And I'm the third child. I was quite big age gaps, and I lived in a little town called Cygnet. And as you said, something quite sad, well, very sad happened. My dad had he was so young, he got a lymphoma cancer, which could have been contributed to all the radiation he experienced in being in the Air Force. He was a navigator in the Air Force, and back then there wasn't the same kind of safety stuff now, and there was quite a lot of radiation exposure. And also he was a farmer and exposed to pesticides and chemicals. And if you know my dad, you know he's not the kind of person to be into like being really safe. It's like, she'll be right.
What age was he is when he first got diagnosed?
He would have been like 43, 42.
Yeah. And how old were you?
So I would have been like 2.
Right.
There's a photo actually of my second birthday, and you can tell his dad is sick, but at that time he kind of hadn't told anyone. I mean, he had a lot of symptoms, and he'd actually, was it Christmas? The last Christmas he was alive, he made my mum promise that she wouldn't tell anyone that he was sick. And he hadn't, you know, had medical care or anything at that point. And yeah, mum was, you know, bound to secrecy. And that is so heartbreaking. And there's so many what ifs, but it's that thing of if dad had gone to a doctor sooner, if he had been prepared to show vulnerability. And I say that extreme end of toxic masculinity is not even allowing yourself to see a doctor for a physical health problem. And so, yeah, dad died, I think, 9 months after being diagnosed. And I was just before I turned 3. And that was obviously a challenging time in the family. And then mum got, you know, quite bad depression afterward.
And how old, sorry, is were your siblings?
My brother was 15, and then my sister was 8.
And I'm interested because you obviously talk about it now with a level of detail, albeit you're only 2 or almost 3. Have obviously since then, it's been a bit of time. Have you spoken to your siblings about it, your mum about it? Do you have, you know, particular conversations around birthdays or Christmases and really sort of talk about your dad?
It's a really good question, Hugo. And I think part of why I'm so passionate about talking about my dad now is he actually wasn't really discussed after he died when we were very little. I think I don't want to go into it too much due to the, you know, privacy of my family, but I think my mum was almost angry at dad for dying and leaving her in that situation. And sadly, there weren't any photos of him around the house, and birthdays and, you know, anniversary of his death weren't really celebrated or recognized. And I think I almost felt guilty when I was little for saying that I was sad about my dad dying, because that was like saying, you know, my mum's not doing a good job, or and I wanted to put on a brave front, I think, even as a really little kid. So then as an adult, I really realized that something was missing from me. I didn't, you know, I had one, my dad, who was still my dad, even if he wasn't there, and he wasn't acknowledged and celebrated. And I think part of why Movember is so special for me is that, you know, Tommy Windsor, who also lost his dad, and some other amazing people really made me feel like, Izzy, you deserve to grieve and mourn. And I actually was sitting with a psychologist not long ago, and I remember saying to her, oh, like, well, you know, I was young, so it wasn't as hard on me compared to my siblings. And then when my nieces and nephews were the same age that my dad died, I thought, like, imagine if their dad had died, they would be so impacted. And I saw how much love there was between them. Even if I don't have good memories of that now, it would have had a massive impact. And my psychologist said to me, Izzy, you were little, but you would have felt the grief and the loss, but you wouldn't have actually had the communication or the understanding to really know what was going on. And so even though you didn't properly understand it, you would have felt it. And so that would have had a really big loss. And it's interesting, even we had, you know, Wayne Schwoz on an episode the other day, and we were talking about how we need to learn to communicate how we're feeling. And so I can almost see some parallels between adults and me as a little child.
I've never really thought about it that way, but you're spot on. Although you're at the age where you probably can't vividly remember the, you know, the events itself compared to, say, your siblings or your mum. You put this post up recently, and when you said, my heart still breaks for the little girl who would say to their mum, I've waited and I've waited and I just can't wait anymore. When is daddy coming home? And that actually, I got a few tears when I read that, because you can actually picture that poor little girl, obviously being you, and how sad that must have been, but you don't really understand it, or you can't comprehend it. I think it's really
I know
sad.
For like years I used to, when the first star came out at night, did you have that thing like first star of the night, you make a wish?
No.
I used like a make a wish that my dad would come back, or I'd see people that looked like my dad and I'd wonder like, maybe he didn't really die, or people would say he was in heaven and I'd be like, well, where's heaven? And they're like, it's up in the sky. And I'd wonder which cloud it was, and maybe I could go up and find him.
And so, what were your siblings and your mum, like, how did they go about sort of letting you know, like, where is daddy?
Oh, well, I think they just tried to explain, you know, he's not coming home. And that would have been so heartbreaking. I can't imagine what it was like for my siblings. But it's interesting, after he died, actually, I stopped, like, talking. And I think that really demonstrates that it was a very traumatic experience. Like, I stopped like using language, and you know, they actually worried that I had an intellectual disability because my language skills were so poor, which is funny now because I make up for it because I'm so chatty.
What age was that? Is that, was that like very soon after when you were sort of three?
So about three. And then I can remember, like, I didn't talk at all for ages. And then there's this story of me having like not spoken. And then all of a sudden, I think we were on holiday, and I just said, geez, it's a hot night tonight. And everyone was just like flabbergasted. But I think, yeah, so that was the experience. And it's only been in recent years that I've really acknowledged that it was trauma, and that has it had an impact on me, and probably impacts my reactions to, you know, certain experiences now and relationships. I have real fear of loss. You know, with my boyfriend's a cyclist, I get so anxious about him riding, or I always think about like him dying, which is really, you know, he's young and healthy. Why would I think that? But I guess it's just been really good for me to understand and acknowledge that, you know, those experiences did impact me, and, you know, that my kids won't have granddad, or, you know, I won't have a dad when I get married. And that is why I'm so passionate about Movember. And I think with Movember, and you're an ambassador, and you'd understand, we're both so busy, and sometimes we've been stressed about, you know, raising money this year and doing everything right, and we can get a bit overwhelmed. But when I go back to those core reasons why I do it, and as you say, I think about that little girl, that's like, that's my why. And it sounds cliche, but, you know, I wouldn't want other people to go through that, especially if it can be prevented.
No, it's really special to hear you say that, Izzy, and thanks for opening up. I personally, didn't really know the details about sort of what it would have been like, and even just hearing you talk about it, it's so enlightening. And I just want to thank you for that. And without sort of, like you said, going to too much detail about your family members as a whole, I just want to know what it was like grieving yourself, you know, learning who you are as a young girl growing up, and then also having to potentially manage or look after what your mum was going through as well. That must have been pretty challenging.
Yeah, and it's interesting talking about learning and growing up, because it is a forever journey. We talk, you know, often in the kind of wellness and like pop psychology, they talk about, you know, inverted commas, healing. And it's like life is an ongoing, you know, healing journey, and I'm still learning heaps. But in terms of growing up, it was tough, and we had a lot of financial problems, and there was quite a lot of stress. And, you know, my mum did the best job she could without much support, but we really had a lot of worries and responsibility on us of children that children shouldn't have to shoulder. And that happens to a lot of people. You know, there's children all around the world with responsibilities and pressures and hardships that no children should, you know, go through. And mine were probably much less worse than many others. But I think it did give me some positives as well, in that I became incredibly independent and hardworking. And I think being, you know, poor, like, it's not a coincidence. My sister's a lawyer, I'm a doctor, and my brother's in property. Like, people that say, like, you know, money doesn't matter have never been poor, because, you know, struggling about money really is a stress. So I think it also made me really value connection and relationships my granddad was like the archetypal best granddad. So that's my dad's dad. Like, he was the kind of guy that you'd say, "Granddad, I'm bored." And he'd be like, "Well, how about we go and make some kites from bamboo sticks and newspaper?" Or, you know, he built us a go-kart out of like some old fence palings, you know. Or he had been in the Air Force. He's an engineer. And he's like, I'd say, like, "Grandpa, how does a plane fly?" He's like, "You go away for 10 minutes. I'll draw some drawings and you come back and then I'll teach you." And, you know, he's drawn out all these diagrams. So I think, you know, I talk about the hardships, but there was also so much beautiful love and community. And I grew up in the country and, you know, I just walked down to the neighbors and I was like family. So I think there was, and that's really taught me about, you know, what protective things for young people. And, you know, you can be poor and have hardships, but that community and the connection and support was so important. So, you know, some hard lessons, but also some important ones and, you know, values that I'm, you know, happy to have now.
Love that is when I was actually going to ask you who that sort of father figure was growing up in your life. And it sounds like you've got a beautiful relationship with your granddad, which is amazing. And I love those little memories that we can all reminisce with that with our family. And you talk about your dad having very high IQ, and it's probably no coincidence that you're pretty brainy and pretty smart. You obviously sort of taken those traits from your dad. But at what age do you think it was where you were going through school and you decided that, you know what, I think, you know, medicine or being a doctor is what I want to do? Because I feel like I had that thought early days and I thought, yeah, that sounds pretty good, but I think you've really got to want it. You can't just sort of one day wake up and say, "I might be a doctor today." So what led you down that path?
Funny thing is, I kind of did.
Maybe you are just extremely brainy then.
It's funny. So like, Hugo, I went all through, and another thing that makes me realize that in inverted commas, success is a lot due to luck. I didn't actually go that well at school. Like maybe well in primary school, but high school, I was obsessed with sport and, you know, being cool and being invited to the, you know, cool guys party. And then randomly in grade 10, I had my first boyfriend who was a cool guy, but really into maths and science. And we ended up going to the same, like in Tasmania, grade 11, 12 is different. And we studied really hard together. I had one amazing teacher, like Diane Carsley at Guildford Young College. If you're listening, thank you. I do send her a card every now and then.
That's great.
And I didn't have much confidence when I was young. No, I didn't really have the role models in terms of, you know, there was no aunt that was a doctor or, you know, uncle that had been an engineer. I didn't really ever think that was something I would be capable of. But I had an amazing teacher and got some really good grade 11 and 12 exam scores, good at maths and science. And then interestingly, I actually got an autoimmune kidney disease not long after finishing grade 12. And I came from a non-medical family, and it's absolutely terrifying being told, "Oh, you have kidney failure." Like, you know, my sister's on the phone being like, "I'll donate a kidney if you need me." And I think that experience, I had some really wonderful experiences with the healthcare system, and some that made me feel really alienated and unsupported. And it really did demonstrate the power of a caring doctor that feels invested in your health. Even if the advice they give is completely the same, the outcome feels so different. And I really did want to be that good doctor. And I'm sure my dad dying of, you know, cancer also had some part of me wanting to work in healthcare. So yeah, I randomly got in grade 12 and was like, "Oh, I'll give it a go." And then I was like, "Maybe I'll change and do physio or something else." But once you're in, you're like, "Oh my God, I'm going to be a doctor one day." So you just stick with it. And then, you know, here I am almost 15 years later.
Yeah, you're doing amazing things, and you've got, I can't wait to see where you go next with everything. I'm looking forward to you moving back to Sydney.
Yay, me too.
But the alarming sort of statistics, mental illness around junior doctors. And I just want to ask, when you were going through your studies and being a junior doctor, and when you went through that, did you personally experience some of that, you know, poor mental health over the years? Do you still experience some of that poor mental health? And why do you think it is that these junior doctors seem to struggle so much with their mental health?
Yeah, it's often put down to doctors' personalities, which I call utter bullshit, because there's lots of people with personalities of being hardworking and perfectionists, but the one thing doctor suicide has in common is their profession. In terms of in medical school, I never really was that stressed out. I think I had accepted, I didn't care that much about my marks. I'd get, you know, credits and distinctions. That was fine. I didn't put my self-worth on my, you know, my exam scores. And I think that was because I hadn't actually been that academic before university. And I worked, you know, a waitressing job and a tutoring job the whole time. So I was really busy. And I can remember hearing when I was a medical student about, you know, doctor mental health and doctor stress. And I just thought they were being ungrateful. Or, you know, they're not resilient enough. Like, come on. And then I became a doctor. And it's the responsibility of looking after people's health, which I just had no idea about. And I think for me as well, a quality that I have picked up partly from medicine and partly maybe to do with some of my youth is if I make a mistake, I feel like I'm a bad person and I get a lot of shame. And when I have that feeling, I really go into myself and really burn myself up about it. So they were some experiences I had, you know, which are partly my personality. But for junior doctors, there's this impossible workload. There's this culture of people having responsibilities that they just don't have the experience to be doing. You know, you're a junior registrar, which means you're like a semi-senior doctor after only being there for 3 years. And there's just a culture of being like passive aggressive and condescending. And then mixed in with all of that, there's specialist exams that you're studying 20, 30 hours a week, as well as working full time. And then it's really hard to get into programs. And I think because it's so hard to not get such investment bias and put your whole self-worth on it, because we've all been doing it since we were 18 and we've sacrificed so much. So then thinking I've been doing this for 13 years and then I might not become a cardiologist because I'll fail this exam. And I think probably always the biggest one was the impact of people dying and the impact of people's health. And I do get really emotionally impacted. And now I work in endocrinology where pretty much people never die from endocrine problems. So that suits me much better.
You talked about the pressure. You know, if I make a mistake at work or if I have a bad day at work, you know, typically it's not really going to be too impactful to other people. Whereas if you have a bad day or make a big mistake at work with a client or with a patient, it could be extremely impactful to the patient, to yourself. And I can see sort of the follow-on effects it can have. And you then mentioned dealing with loss, and death is obviously a big part of being doctor, and obviously certain specialties. And do you just want to touch on, if you feel comfortable to do so, when you experienced your first loss with a patient? And you talk about how you kind of then unpack some stuff with a psychologist. But what was that like when you actually did experience that?
Well, there's definitely loss commonly from the start. And the ones that impacted me were I was working in bone marrow transplants, and that's for people with acute leukemias, and they come in well and we give them a bone marrow transplant. And we had some people die from the treatment. And that's a known side effect. It occurs in about 20%. And I really felt like we were playing Russian roulette with patients' lives. And there was one patient who was a lovely man. And I especially get impacted by kind of middle-aged men, which I'm sure is to do with, you know, the loss of my father. And he came in well, had been playing his guitar, you know, cracking jokes. And I just gradually saw him decline. And, you know, the treatment we gave him, he died from. And that was when I realized I couldn't work in blood cancers. And I think what the worst part was, I was then told by my senior doctors, if you're getting this so upset, you need to think about doing a different career. And the reality was they were correct, but the way they said it, you know, there was no follow-up support, no emotional support. They knew that I'd been really impacted. And it was like, well, she's weak. You know, she can't deal with this. And that was really alienating. So that was, and you know, if there's any people that work, nurses, junior doctors, paramedics, I want you to know that if you get emotionally impacted by patients dying, that doesn't make you weak. That shows that you care and you're human, and that's part of your strength. And it's tough because it is a strength, but it does impact you a lot. And then finally, the other one that I really say was the absolute worst point of my mental health experiences was I felt like I missed some results of a patient and that may have contributed to them dying. And I've never felt so bad or so worthless or not really wanting to live until that moment. I'd never had anything like that. And I'd been told, you know, you will have that experience at one point and it's terrible. And I think, you know, I was out in the country, I was working in a hospital, country hospital with no support. I'd just done my specialist exams. I was so burnt out. And, you know, I was in the fetal position crying, I think on the floor of my little crappy apartment that I was put up in. and just not feeling like I deserve to live because I had let that other person down. And I think that was what sparked me taking a year off medicine and a wonderful journey since of much improved mental health and personal learning. But it's a shame I had to get to that rock bottom place. And that's why I advocate for junior doctor well-being, because I'd never want someone to feel like they don't deserve to be on this planet because they made a mistake in an incredibly unsupported environment in medicine. And unfortunately, that happens all the time. And only 2 weeks ago, another junior doctor in Sydney died from suicide.
It's pretty alarming, I think, like when you're just hearing you say about when that experience you had and the senior doctors were kind of, you know, it's almost stopped being weak, like it's part of your job. And I think I never really thought about it that way. But like I said before, you make not even a mistake, but you do something that you continually, you go to bed at night and you're just lying awake thinking, shit, could have I done that differently?
Yeah, 100%. I used to go home and think about patients in my mind after they had passed away. And even though I wasn't involved, but it was just, you know, I really connect with people and I feel their energy. And yeah, you do, you go home at night and, you know, think about what could have happened and could have been different.
Yeah. Well, it's great to hear your mental health is great at the moment. But how old were you when you said you had that year off and you were in that really rock bottom?
So that was the year of my specialist exams. And there'd also been lots of other things going on. My sister had a baby and then got a really bad neck injury, and I was trying to support her. One of my friends got addicted to illicit substances, and I was trying to support them to get to rehab. Then I had, you know, a boyfriend break up with me when we were on holiday, and the specialist exams. And then I got back and had to locum in bloody Mildura. Not locum do, so like a 3-month term, but I would have been 27, 28.
Wow. See, I didn't even... You know, I know you quite well now, and I didn't know you had that year off and the extent of what you actually went through on a personal level about how you're feeling. And were you diagnosed with mental illness back then, or did you kind of just manage it yourself?
A part of the problem with medicine is that you are so busy that you don't have time to see a psychologist, and people might say you always have time, but you're literally working 8 a.m. till 9:30 p.m. often. And then you're studying for these special exams on top of that. And you're just so, so stressed that you wouldn't even be in the right mind frame to see a psychologist to unpack things. But, you know, I really hit rock bottom, realized I didn't know what I wanted to do in medicine. And the following year, I took a year off and just locumed. And it was the absolute best decision I've ever made, because personal growth actually requires time to think. If you're so busy and so stressed that you don't have time to be self-reflective and try and recognize how you're feeling, you're just in survival mode. You know, you don't have time to think about everything else and try and unpack what's going on. And it takes a degree of, you know, work. Whether I was diagnosed, I would have had a significantly high psychological stress, which in some ways is a diagnosis. I think that's what I would have had. And then also burnout. But after that year, I started seeing the psychologist that I'm still seeing now, and I hadn't seen a psych for probably over 5 years. I'd seen one when my grandpa died when I was about 20. And then I saw a lovely psychologist who, you know, I still see, and we did a lot of work and stuff to do with my family, my relationships, you know, medicine. And, you know, I read lots of books, you know, Brené Brown, that was amazing. I feel like reading Brené Brown has helped me just as much as seeing a psychologist. Sorry, Loretta.
I love the fact you've still got that amazing relationship though with your psychologist. And we often talk about it in this podcast, is finding that psychologist that's right for you and treating them like almost like a family member. Yeah, exactly.
And it's interesting. I think especially after my grandpa died, I felt like I didn't have that secure kind of almost parental attachment role of someone you can really rely on. And in some ways, a psychologist can play that role for you. And, you know, I can remember saying, I'm so embarrassed that you're the person I have to go to. And she's like, Izzy, don't be silly. But yeah, no, she was really good. And because a big part of my stress was not knowing what I wanted to do in medicine, because I'd been working on it since I was like 18 and I was 28 and realized I didn't want to be a cancer doctor. But then thought about what are my values and what are my passion, and I love exercise and I love helping people and keeping them well rather than treating disease. That's something I realized I love mental health, And I had this eureka moment of endocrinology. You know, you're keeping young people with, let's say, type 1 diabetes well, and mental health is so important in that area. And it could combine my love of sport and exercise. So if I hadn't have had that year off and had the time to really reflect on what those values and passions were and learn about what I wanted to do with my life, I wouldn't have got to endocrinology. So I really think taking a break can be really beneficial.
And that's applies to everyone. Obviously, you know, you're talking about doctors or junior doctors who work those, you know, unbelievable hours during the week, but anyone who's facing that stressful work life. And it's kind of an interesting point I want to ask you is that you took that year off, right? Which is great. It obviously was exactly what you needed. It's great advice. But outside of taking that year off and you continue to have long hours and shift work and all that, the advice, not only for doctors and junior doctors, but also for everyone, how do you balance your work and personal life? Because I know we often talk about that when, like, even now we're doing a recording on a weekend and you've got your personal life too, and you've got your beautiful partner, Paul, and people listening to that, when they think they're just, you know, nonstop working all the time, coming home, studying, you know, how do they manage their work life and their personal life?
I'm just going to say one thing about the year off, because I recognize the privilege I had as a doctor to have that opportunity, because I could locum and earn enough money that I could work part-time and still survive. But I think if people don't have the opportunity to, you know, have a full year off, like if you can cut down some of your responsibilities or work part-time, or even just have a more a prolonged holiday, so you do have that space and time to think. Because now I am back to being just as busy as I was, but I actually manage it a lot better. I get asked this a lot. And firstly, I want to say there's no such thing as, you know, perfect work-life balance, because anything we give our energy to is essentially sacrificing something else. So we need to reflect on what is it that we value and what we're going to put our energy to, and make sure we're only giving it to things that give us something back and are worthy. Also, I'm really passionate about outsourcing. Like, I'm now lucky Paul does a lot of the cooking, but before I used to get like my muscle chef and I'd get a house cleaner. I don't own an iron, because who can be bothered to spend an extra 10 minutes a day ironing a shirt? And I don't own a hairdryer, you know, so getting rid of things that aren't important, you know, they don't add value to your life. And the most important thing I would say is being self-aware and having the right support network. So, you know, working with you, Hugo, I would not be able to do this podcast if, when I said, Hugo, I'm really sorry, I'm too busy, I just can't do this, if you didn't say, Izzy, totally understandable, you know, that's fine. And because we have this relationship, I feel comfortable saying that to you. And I think that, you know, and you could even talk about, you know, your romantic partner, you know, having an actual partner of someone that supports you. And the people in your life being on your team. And that's hard, because it's not like you can just click your fingers and have that. That takes time and work and growth and knowing what you deserve. But then, yeah, being self-aware, and when you're burning out, when you need to, you know, just say, let's put that on hold for 2 weeks. This is important right now. And often it's easy, and I talk about this with my patients, and I actually had one of my pediatric patients say to me the other day, are you a psychologist or a doctor? Because he's like saying, everything is just too hard. I was like, well, let's break it down, because if we say everything is too hard, you know, we're not actually, you know, we're kind of putting our hands up in the air and saying, I can't do this. But if we break it down to each of the individual tasks, then you can feel like, you know, I can get through this challenge. And one final thing, because I'm not perfect, I still do feel overwhelmed sometimes and have a bit of a cry or how can I do this? I look back at my former self and times when I had so much on and I felt like I couldn't get through it. And I'm like, Izzy, you did get through it. You know, it was hard, but you got through it. And that actually really gives me the confidence in myself to know, you know, this, you'll also get through this challenge too.
I love that bit of advice, Izzy. I really do. It's something I try and do as well when you're going through a really difficult time. And for me, if it's my bowels are playing up, or, you know, if your mental health isn't great one day and you're angry and you're frustrated, it's exactly that. It's looking back at some of those really difficult times you've gone through. And you think, you know what, yep, I've gone through that, I can get through this.
And it sounds cliche, being your own inspiration, because you could look up to some other person, but you don't know how their brain works or what their support network is. I really encourage people, you know, don't have someone else, you know, you be your own inspiration and be your own cheerleader.
No, good advice is good advice. So it's that notion that no one's perfect, and I really love that advice. But you mentioned a certain person a couple of times this podcast. His name's Paul. And I just want to hear, I'm a bit of a romantic is, but I want to know, you know, you're living with Paul in Canberra, and Paul's a wonderful guy and sounds like he's really supported you and he's there for you, not only just cooking, but with your little fur baby Arnold. But can you just talk to me about little quick little romantic part of the podcast with how you met Paul and what Paul means to you?
So I met Paul on Instagram because we talked about triathlon and he was a bit quirky and a bit weird, but we lived in like suburbs next to each other. And I was like, maybe we should go for a ride one day. And then Paul told me his age and I was like, damn, he's too old. You know, he actually got his age wrong and said he was like a year older than he was, but Paul was like 12 years older than me. And then we developed this really lovely friendship. And he said, he's only told me this now that we're together, but the first time we went for a ride, we ended up hanging out for like 4 hours and, you know, just talking and talking. And he said that first time we met, it was like catching up with an old friend who it was like, you know, when you haven't seen someone for a while and then you catch up and it's like no time has gone past.
He
became a real support and I moved to Sydney and we would talk on the phone, but I had a real barrier because of the age gap. And you know, he was in Melbourne and I was making this new life in Sydney. And then I think I had a patient. This sounds also like a bit cliche, but it's truth. I had a lady in the hospital who I was looking after and she was maybe in her 50s and she was dying of metastatic cancer. It made me think, life's too short, Izzy. Yeah, Paul's 12 years older, but nothing is guaranteed. And you've got this amazing friendship and connection with someone. Don't throw that away because of some, you know, issue that, you know, when you're 90, he might be dead. And it's kind of cute. I told him that I had a bit of a crush on him and, you know, and then we got separated from the pandemic for like 5-6 months and started this relationship. And then both took a gamble and he was like, I'll move to Canberra with you, even though, you know, we had never really been together. But it just worked out. And there's, you know, been ups and downs, but he has been so caring. And I think it's interesting, if anyone's listening, there's this great audiobook on relationships, Our Brain on Love, that's what it is. And it talks about that your partner does fulfill almost a parenting role, not in a weird way, but they provide you the secure, loving environment that you all should have as children. And that maybe if we didn't feel we had that, that can be incredibly healing. And yeah, I think for the first time with a romantic partner, I've really got that unconditional love and teamwork. And yeah, it's bloody nice. It took, you know, over 30 years to get there, but that's, you know, dating and, you know, ups and downs, and you've got to go through the shitty experiences to, you know, realize when you're onto something really good. But yeah, he's a great support. I'm really lucky.
I love hearing you talk about Paul and you get a big smile on your face and
I'm blushing at the moment.
No, I love it. It's great. And like I said earlier, I can't wait for you both back in Sydney and
we'll
can
get you trained
up
for a marathon.
I've said that before and I've dropped the ball and I think it's because you're not here, Izzy. I need a bit of that, buddy.
Yeah. Centennial Park. Well, Matt, Paul could do your programming. He's he's a triathlon sports coach. So we'll get Paul training you, me cheering you, Amber on board. It'll be good.
No, sounds good. And we'll get the dogs, Arnold, Ernie and Rupert, running around too. I think you're spot on. And, you know, we'll probably talk about this in the part two of this little edition when you kind of flip the tide and interview me. But I think, partners, relationships, when you go through difficult times, that's what can really strengthen the bonds. And I always say I'm forever grateful for the support Amber provided me and what it sounds like, you know, when you do the long distance with Paul and just having someone there for you and someone you can talk to and share your problems with and just generally be there for you. I think so important.
Yeah.
So look, Iz, I want to just before we sort of wrap up, and we've got a couple of little back end questions before we get to the last question, which we ask all our guests, and you're now the guest today, Iz.
Oh, I haven't prepared that one, but yes.
And it's to do with Movember. We're both absolutely proud ambassadors for Movember. And for those listening who have supported Movember this month, thank you. It's a wonderful foundation close to our heart, but we're both taking a bit of a step back this particular Movember campaign. And what I mean by that is, you know, the big fundraising events and, you know, what goes into that. It is very time consuming. And I found personally leading up to this month of Movember, had lots going on. I was putting this stress and this pressure on myself and it was like not a comfortable feeling. And I just want to ask you what it feels like just sort of taking that step back. Obviously, you contribute in so many other ways and it's a good opportunity to let the listeners know that it's okay to say no.
Yeah. And first, I'll just you know, briefly say about Movember, and something I really want people to know is the men's health projects they fund are just incredible, and they really do target need. Most of their projects are often focusing on rural areas, people from social disadvantage, Indigenous communities. So even if the Movember, what you might see in terms of the hipster guys with the moustaches and the fundraising, the money is really going to the most amazing causes and initiatives. And, you know, I work in healthcare and I see that there's so much bureaucracy in government stuff, whereas Movember doesn't have that. So they can say, hey, we want to get these guys some surfboards or some bikes. That's going to get them healthier. That's going to get them mentally healthier. The government doesn't have programs to fund that. And I see that with my patients with type 2 diabetes. One guy, you know, lost his job, had to sell his bike, couldn't exercise. The government's spending hundreds and hundreds of dollars, you know, per year, if not more, on medications for his diabetes. They just bought him his bike back. He probably wouldn't need them. And I think that's where charities like Movember are so important and critical. So if you jump on their website and look at, you know, there's over 1,200 initiatives they funded. So many of them are so great. And, you know, so please take a look. And then in terms of, yeah, this year, so I've been doing Movember for almost 10 years and I've raised over $20,000. And often I do a big fundraiser. When I started, I was a poor medical student and I don't think I minded asking people for money as much, but I've been doing it for 10 years now. And especially with COVID, I think exactly what you said, you just didn't feel comfortable. And I didn't feel comfortable doing a big fundraiser either. I think I've done it many times and it's not my strength. And then I felt so guilty that I, you know, was I being a bad ambassador? Was I not caring enough? And it's funny because all the Movember staff are like, Izzy, don't think that at all. You do so much. It's like, we need to believe people when we say, hey, I'm sorry, I can't do this, or, you know, I can't come to this event or XYZ. When people are generally saying it's okay, you know, respect that and believe them. And it's okay. You're not a bad person or not a good friend if, you know, you can't be everyone, everything to everyone all the time. So yeah, I'm taking also a bit of a step back. And I think doing this podcast, I'm also looking at my strengths and my skills. And, you know, we had Josh on the podcast where we talked about doing what your strengths are. And I think, you know, our strengths are really storytelling and sharing a Movember and those important messages about mental health. And that has helped me feel better. And also knowing I'm getting other people involved in Movember. And my cousin Sam will listen to this episode. He likes being dropped, he's told me. he did Movember for the first time last year because of listening to our podcast. And he's doing it. I'm sure, he's a cattle farmer in Queensland. I'm sure he's now encouraged other people to do Movember, and that flow-on effect. So, you know, we can give back in so many ways. And I think for me, valuing that, you know, it's not just about money and we all have lots of skills and, you know, we can give back in lots of different ways.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. And it's interesting, you just mentioned your medical advice on Instagram and social media. I just want to quickly touch on it. I was looking at your Instagram before and there's a few people that been saying pretty mean messages, I think. And it's today, I know you've probably got thick skin and you probably don't read too much into it, but we're all human. We've touched on that. And what is that like when 99% of your followers absolutely love what you say and they appreciate what you do in that space? But when you get the occasional few people that inbox you or comment on your post saying, Izzy, you have no idea what you're talking about, blah, blah, blah. How does that impact you?
Well, I think what you're referring to are people, you know, my grandma is 95 and I'm getting a COVID booster because I could not think of anything worse than giving my grandma COVID. And so, of course, I had people saying, you know, you're bought by Big Pharma and you're XYZ and you're killing people. That stuff just makes me sad because it shows people, vulnerable people, are being brainwashed by conspiracies, and there's, you know, been some excellent environments to allow that to happen. So there's no anger towards those people. It just, you know, makes me sad. The other things about social media and, you know, not everyone liking or agreeing what you say, that's actually been a really good lesson for me to apply to the rest of my life, because I dreadfully love being liked. I'm a people pleaser. I worry so much about upsetting or offending people. You know, if Paul's feeling a bit down, I'm like, what have I done? Tell me. I get so stressed by it. And that initially happened with the social media, but I've accepted I'm not going to be everyone's cup of tea, because everyone is different and it's just impossible. And sometimes you feel like you need to change yourself to try and appease everyone. And that's just impossible, and then feels really fake if I'm not being true to myself.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, as I touched on, I'm pretty sure the vast majority, bloody overwhelming support that you are, that you have, and I always call it the Izzy fan club.
Oh, stop it.
It's I love the Izzy fan club. It's but no, thanks, Izzy. And look, actually, two more questions, and I just put this down before because I was interested in it, because I look at you as a doctor, you know, your blue scrubs, your medical lingo, half the bloody thing, stuff I don't even understand. You're extremely intelligent, you're smart, you're doing some amazing things. But if you weren't a doctor, what would your dream job be, or what do you think you'd be doing?
I actually talked to Paul about this morning, and I said, I always wanted to be an astronaut. He's like, well, you know, you'd need a PhD in like engineering and something else. I was like, it's about the dream job.
Yeah, exactly.
But yes, I love the idea of space. And that's I think cool. I've always been fascinated with how big the world is and how small we are and essentially insignificant, and how that is a exciting and terrifying and confusing concept all in itself. But I think if I was doing a more realistic job, it would have to be something to do with communication and people. And I love connecting with people, and that's a real strength. And, you know, what is medicine to me is all about. So exactly what that is, I'm not sure. But
I love that though. The maybe we should ask our guests. I love that dream job, because it's kind of dream big. Doesn't matter, you know, there's no boundaries. Astronaut. I didn't pick you for an astronaut, but that's cool. And you also make a pretty good doctor as well. So you should be bloody proud of all the amazing work you continue to do. And that leads us on to the very last question. And we've heard some amazing mental health and wellbeing challenges from our 15 or so guests we've had so far. But I'm interested to know, what is Dr. Izzy Smith's mental health and wellbeing challenge for me, which I'll go away and try to do, and also for the listeners?
Unfortunately, it's been repeated a few times, so I'm not going to say go to bed earlier, but that is something that is so, so critical to my own wellbeing. So instead, I'm going to say, really make an effort to be super friendly to people you'll never see again. A few years ago, I had an experience and it was like a eureka moment, and I'm going to be super friendly to people at work, to the people at the coffee shop. And it feels a bit silly at the start, and then you realize how much you get back from the conversation with the barista, the person at the supermarket. You know, I'm not always like this. Sometimes I let it slide when I'm tired, but I've really found putting in a conscious effort to be bubbly and friendly when you're never going to see the person again. So there's really not much point to it apart from making both of your moments better. So that would be my challenge.
I love it. And you're spot on. It makes you feel great. Like it's not hard.
Yeah.
It's not hard at all. Like I got my little morning coffee this morning, and you just give that extra little smile, or that extra have a great day, guys, or just ask that little question to the person making your coffee. It's not hard, but it makes you feel good. It makes them feel good.
It's a win-win.
So I love that. It's a really nice way to finish. And you know what, I've really enjoyed this last, you know, hour or so chatting. It's nice to get you on the other side, behind the uniform.
You'll be in the hot seat next, Hugo.
I know, I'm a bit nervous actually getting I don't know, like we have plenty of chats offline, but actually interviewing each other. But no, I've really enjoyed it. Is as always, so much advice, but more importantly, I think it's been great to unpack some of your you know, you always brush it to the side because you, like you keep saying, you know, you don't think people are interested in your personal life or your journey. But I think so many people would really appreciate the last hour or so. And thank you for being open, honest and vulnerable, as our good friend Gus Wallander always says. So thanks, Iz. I can't wait to hear what people think. Till next time.
Thanks, Hugo.
Thanks, Iz. Have a good day.